Hi, everyone. My name is Maya, and welcome to Psych Mike, the podcast that explores the lives and career paths of industry leaders who use psychology to make an impact in the world. This week, I sat down with Dr. Jill Stoddard, who is a licensed clinical psychologist and director of the Center for Stress and Anxiety Management in San Diego. She received her PhD in clinical psychology from Boston University, where she trained at the renowned Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders. And it was there that her passion for treating anxiety using evidence-based methods took root. Jill now specializes in the treatment of anxiety and related disorders and has expertise in acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT, and cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT. She's an award-winning teacher, peer-reviewed ACT trainer, author, and co-host of the popular Psychologists Off the Clock podcast. She's written two books based on acceptance and commitment therapy. One is called The Big Book of ACT Metaphors, A Practitioner's Guide to Experiential Exercises and Metaphors in Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. And the second one is called Be Mighty, A Woman's Guide to Liberation from Anxiety, Worry, and Stress Using Mindfulness and Acceptance. Both of those books are linked in the show notes. Now, despite all of this obvious success, Jill still experiences imposter syndrome. Again, she founded an incredibly successful center for anxiety treatment. She's written two books. She's working on her third. She's a renowned expert in acceptance and commitment therapy. I didn't even mention that she's given a TEDx talk. She's a highly requested speaker. And she's the co-founder of a nonprofit in San Diego that aims to promote the standards of evidence-based therapy among clinicians in the community. And yet, she still sometimes feels like a fraud. Jill highlights how it's possible to feel like an imposter and still continue to do bold things despite that, because they're important to you. Jill doesn't let her imposter feelings keep her stuck, small, and stagnant. And what I love about Jill in this episode is she doesn't talk about imposter syndrome as this like clinical term in this cloud and as just like a concept. She makes it real by giving examples in her own life where she's felt it. And I resonated. And she even talks about, you know, the different types of imposter feelings that you may have and how they present themselves. So if you've ever found yourself feeling like a fraud, like you don't belong, like you're not good enough for your titles or your experiences, which by the way, 70% of us feel at one point or another, I encourage you to listen to this episode with Jill. I have seldom found a more helpful way to approach these feelings than the way Jill approaches them and the way she talks about them. So besides spending a lot of time talking about imposter syndrome during this episode, we talk about so much more, like the moment that Jill knew that she was on the right path pursuing clinical work. We talk about why she chose to work with anxiety as a specialty, why she decided to open up her own treatment center, and the challenges and benefits of that. We also talk about financial stability and salaries. She literally talks numbers with us, takes us through the salaries that she's had throughout her career, the financial benefits of having her own treatment center. And I just think that's really hard to come by. As you will probably see very soon, authenticity is one of Jill's most important values. And this conversation is no exception to her embodiment of that. As you probably know, a goal of mine with this podcast is to help you explore different career paths through the experiences and advice of inspiring professionals. And it is impossible to do that well without their honest reflections. And I'm so happy to say that Jill does that and more in today's episode. So I hope that you enjoyed today's episode with the mighty Dr. Jill Stoddard. Good morning, Jill. It's nice to have you here.
Hi, Maya. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's such an honor. It is such an honor. I think I told you last time that I've been kind of following your work for a while now, and I had a little bit of an imposter moment when you responded to me or when we got connected. And it's such an honor to be chatting with you today. The reason I sort of became aware of your work is through another guest that I had on this podcast, Dr. Bridget Henry, who trained at the Center for Stress and Anxiety Management, when she was in grad school, and she mentioned your work and that you were a huge influence on her life. So naturally, I went and picked up your book, Be Mighty, which I thoroughly enjoyed, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But it's really an honor to have you here, Jill. Thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure. I love to talk about psychology and nerd out about career stuff.
I know you do. And if you guys are left wanting more from Jill after this, I'm sure you will. So go check out Psychologists Off the Clock as well. It is her podcast that she co-hosts with two other psychologists, one of whom I've already interviewed, Dr. Yael Schoenbrunn. And that is just, it's so good. I'm listening to it all the time now. It's really awesome.
It's fun to do.
Okay, so let's dive right in to your career, Jill. The first thing I want to know is, what turned you on to psychology, and specifically to clinical psychology?
I knew from a very early age that I wanted to go into this field, which I actually feel really lucky about. And when I was in high school, we had a few non-traditional classes we were allowed to take, you know, accounting and pre-law and psychology. And I loved those courses. I mean, specifically psychology and law just completely fascinated me. You know, I think the people aspect of both of them is what really fascinated me. And so I knew I would major in one of those two things. And then I did a summer internship at a law firm. And, you know, from that point on, it was very clear it was going to be psychology.
What was it about the law firm that was like, no, thank you?
I don't think I could have put my finger on it at the time. It was more of a gut feeling, but in retrospect, I think I was aware that it was like kind of a good old boy type environment where a young woman was going to have a harder time in that field. Sexism basically is the bottom line, patriarchy. And so I majored in psychology in college, and then clinical. I mean, I just was always really fascinated by psychopathology and, you know, wanting to be able to help people live their best lives, even when they struggle and suffer.
So my audience is, or a lot of my audience is at the stage right now where they're either like making sense of what they want to do. If they know they want to do clinical work, they're kind of gathering these experiences that will help them become competitive applicants to graduate school. I'm personally in a stage right now where I'm not sure I want to do clinical work, but in the last few months, I've been kind of pulled to it through conversations with clinicians like you. And I guess the question that's been on my mind is, how do I know if I'm suited for clinical work? And I wonder how you figured out early on that you were suited for it.
Well, I think the thing you hear therapists of any ilk, whether it's a psychologist or not, but you hear all the time is, I was always the person people talked to. You know, I was a good listener. I liked, if I was, you know, in a bar talking to a random stranger, within 30 seconds, I'd be hearing their entire life story and their difficult relationship with their parent. And, you know, that was just sort of a vibe I think I had. You know, I had a boyfriend who once said to me, we were fighting about something, and he said, you know, this is what I get for dating a psychologist. I think I was a grad student at the time. And I said, no, you have this all wrong. I'm not this way because I'm in this field. I'm in this field because I'm this way. Right? That like, I just like to talk to other humans in a deep and meaningful way about the things that challenge them. And so I think that's why therapy, you know, doing therapy spoke to me. And I mean, as far as the question of like, how do you know if you're suited? I've never really thought about that. I mean, I think anyone can be suited to anything if they have a passion for it. You know, no matter the career path you take, you're going to run into challenges. But I don't think that means a person isn't suited to something. And so I think as long as you care about other human beings and care about helping them to live their best lives, you can be a great therapist.
Was there ever any doubt? And I mean, I know you had that little stint at the law firm, and then it became therapy. But was there, when you were still deciding on what you wanted to do, was there any doubt in your mind, or was there any other aspect of psychology that you were exploring, or was it always like, I think it's going to be clinical.
Well, there was no doubt in my mind, but I'll say, I think that's because I didn't know there was anything else. So for example, I had no idea that forensic psychology was a thing. And when I figured that out, I was like, oh, my love of law and psychology could have been blended into one career. I just had no idea. Or industrial organizational psychology, I didn't know existed until I was already getting a master's in clinical. And I've become much more interested in my, I don't know, am I mid-career, late career? I don't know where I am, but you know, later, I'm a middle-aged lady now. You know, I've become much more interested in business and leadership and, you know, elements of IO that I thought, gosh, if I had known either of these things existed, then I would have had a harder decision, a harder decision to make. So I didn't have doubt, but I also had no idea that there were so many other hats I could have worn.
We will talk about all those hats that you now wear as a clinical psychologist. And I think it's so cool. It's something that keeps coming up on this podcast is, you know, once you have a PhD or not even like, even if you're just licensed, it doesn't matter how you got licensed. Like there are so many different ways that you can make use of that background and that knowledge and those skills to help people in so many different settings. And to diversify, you know, your day-to-day life.
Absolutely.
So we'll talk about that. So you went to the University of Vermont, correct?
Mm-hmm. And for my undergrad, yes.
For your undergrad. Yeah. Actually, let's stay on undergrad for one more second. Were there any sort of salient experiences that you had as an undergrad, either with a mentor, in a classroom, even like with friends or in your personal relationships that that you think was kind of like the springboard to your next sort of career step? And the reason I ask this is because I guess I'm more interested in the angle of like what are things that people in my audience can like do while they're still in undergrad to really harness the experiences and the resources that they have at their disposal to make the most of that. Yeah.
Well, I think your podcast is so great for this reason, because in much the same way I had no idea that forensic and IO were a thing, I also had very little help, knowledge, support, experience as an undergrad. I mean, I had no idea what the path of a clinical psychologist would look like. And they were things that I learned in hindsight. You know, there's so much of, gosh, I just wish I knew then what I know now. And now your listeners can know those things now instead of when it feels a little too late. And so, you know, some of those things are maybe most predominantly is to get into a PhD, clinical PhD program, really probably any clinical psych program, you have to have research background. You have to have a research background. I didn't even know what a poster was, you know, a research poster that you present at a conference. I had never heard that term until I was already applying to graduate programs. So, you know, I really felt behind, and I wish that I had known, you know, it would benefit me to volunteer to work in someone's lab, to be a research assistant, to speak up and request that I be added as an author onto a paper or a poster, not just added as an author, but to do the work on those projects and be included in that way. And I had no idea. And so, you know, if I could go back and do it again, how would I figure that out? I think I would speak up more, you know, kind of find a self-appointed mentor and just, you know, ask more questions of people who were doing the work that I thought I was going to want to do later.
I have struggled in the past with finding those, you know, self-appointed mentors, and it's easier to go through, you know, more structured ways of finding those mentors, whether that's, you know, doing an honors thesis where that's kind of built in. So if I applied to do an honors thesis, I had a reason to ask somebody to be my mentor. And that's what I did. But I think a lot of students struggle with finding a mentor. It's like, yeah, I know I need one. I know it's important, but like, how do I ask for somebody's time? How do I prove that I'm worth it? How do I, and then how do I be a good mentee? So you are now a mentor to so many. If somebody were to come up to you and ask you in some ways to be their mentor, whether that was, what would you want them to say? What would you want them to have done with you prior to agreeing to take that on?
Yeah. Well, I think going back to the, you know, if you're in undergrad, that kind of experience, you know, some programs are really good at this and others aren't. So pretty much everyone has an academic advisor, and I did too. But as a mentee, I just sort of assumed this person would hold my hand and tell me what I needed to do. Mm-hmm. And some probably do, but others, I think probably expected me to ask the questions. And I just didn't know that. I didn't know that that was my role, you know, that I had to do that. And then I think the other piece of your question, gosh, the thing that comes to mind is what not to do.
Okay.
Which that's helpful too. And unfortunately, this happens to me a lot, and it's become sort of a recent pet peeve, which is to go to someone and say something like, I want to write a book, or I want to start a podcast, or I want to go to grad school. What should I do? And they've never even opened Google. Right. Mm-hmm. So like what I want is for, and actually this used to happen when I was a dissertation mentor, when I was faculty. And I had dissertation students. It was like, what's a t-test? I'm like, did you Google it first? Mm-hmm. You know, did you open a book first? What I want is for people to try to answer all the questions they have on their own first. I was telling you before we hit record that I just sent someone to your podcast for this exact reason. Mm. So, you know, there are endless podcasts, books, documents online. There is such a wealth of information out there that you can just get started by Googling and seeing what you can figure out. And then from that research, you know, do the work, put in the effort. And then from that research, you can create a list of questions that feel unanswerable.
Yes.
Or maybe you've gotten four different answers that somehow all conflict with one another. And then you can come to someone and say, hey, you know, I've done all this research. You're successful in this particular area. Do you have 30 minutes that I can, you know, buy you a coffee or meet with you on Zoom and pick your brain about a couple specific questions I have? Mm-hmm. Whether that turns into a formal mentor relationship or not, I mean, that's sort of a different question. And it's a huge question because it depends so much on what stage you're at, you know, whether you're at school and or elsewhere. But that would be sort of my what not to do. And then you can kind of take it from there.
I think that is such great advice. And I echo that. And I think, and I feel like what you're saying now, like, I'm like, yep. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But then if I had heard that, you know, in the middle of my college career as a sophomore or something, I would have been like, oh, you know, like maybe I should Google before I reach out to somebody. And like, cause you're a busy person, you know, you don't want to just take time to answer. But that doesn't mean that you're not happy to help people. Like, I know that you care so much about mentoring and developing, you know, people, who look to you, for help. But yeah, it's like it also shows that you have taken initiative, that you've put in the time and the effort to like get to know this. So you did not go straight to your master's program in clinical psychology, right? Did you take some time off?
Because I didn't realize I needed research experience to get into grad school, when I graduated from my undergrad, I got a research job at Brown University and was there about a year, and then did this crazy 23-year-old, you know, got together with my girlfriends and said, let's move to the other side of the country and live in California because we're young and why not? So then once I was out there, I was in state, I was a resident of California. So then I started doing my master's degree there because I didn't know what I needed to be competitive. I needed that time to be able to build my CV so that I had research experience and publications to make myself a competitive mm-hmm. applicant mm-hmm. for doctoral programs. So that's absolutely not necessary, mm-hmm. Especially if you know in advance that those are things you need to be doing mm-hmm. as an undergrad.
Mm-hmm. I will say that once this episode is released, we will have already released two episodes. English, two episodes broken up. It was a full recording, but we broke it up into two sections, all about, you know, becoming a competitive graduate school applicant with right. a faculty mentor at Columbia, Teachers College, Columbia University, and one of his doctoral students. So if you want to know more about getting into graduate school and what it takes, you should check out the last couple episodes that I will have just put out. Okay, so you did this master's at San Diego State in clinical psychology. Now, just so people are aware, that doesn't mean that at the end of it, you could practice clinically because it wasn't a licensed track program.
That's exactly right. That's exactly okay. right. And I don't think most master's programs no. specify clinical psychology. It just, you know, it meant that the coursework was going to be focused on psychopathology and learning about therapy, but it was honestly sort of a useless degree other than being a stepping stone, because it was not a degree that you could then sit for any type of licensure, you know, like it, unlike an MFT program yeah. or an MSW program where you can yeah. then do hours and sit for licensure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What do you feel like? So I know you mentioned that you got some more research experience, you got to take those courses that would better introduce you to the path. What do you feel like is the number one sort of benefit that master's gave you before you embarked on the PhD journey?
I mean, I think it was two things. One is what you've already said. It gave me the experience and the knowledge, frankly, that that I needed to be ready for a doctoral program. And, you know, the other was, and part of the reason I wanted to do this was, a doctoral program is a huge commitment. You know, I mean, it's pretty grueling for yeah. many, many years. Mm-hmm. And you're gonna have no time and no money. And work your butt off and be really mm-hmm. stressed out. And mm-hmm. I wanted to make sure that like this really was the right path for me. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like doing a shorter degree program where I could kind of test the waters mm-hmm. Was a way to make that determination before, mm-hmm. you know, fully committing both mm-hmm. feet into a doctoral program.
Had you had any like hands-on like clinical experience before BU or no?
In my master's program, yes. We were invited, a couple of the students from my cohort were invited to work at the clinic that, so I was at San Diego State. San Diego State and UCSD have mm-hmm. a joint doctoral program. And a couple master's students were invited to kind of come into that program in the role of, we were basically doing intake assessments in the clinic there. So the student training clinic where the doctoral students were getting trained how to uh-huh. be therapists, uh-huh. we were invited to come in and do intake evaluations for them. And I'll never forget, and I don't have a great memory, the very first day I ever did that, I left the clinic and I was driving home and I just had like goosebumps all over my body. And since that time, I call it my body barometer. And it was just this really powerful moment where I knew that this was what I was meant to do and that I was in the right place. It was really cool.
Mm. You guys should have seen my face, my face when Jill just told that story. I was like, I'm looking for something like that right now. I haven't made sort of active strides right now to seek that out, but I know I'm going to. I want to know if I'll get those, because mm-hmm. I get goosebumps. Like I get from listening to music or even just like watching like a group of people listening to, or at a concert. Like, I don't know. I feel like I'm very prone to goosebumps. So I know if I get goosebumps from like a clinical experience like that, I'm going to feel like, yeah, I think this is for me.
You have the body barometer too.
I guess I do. that's really cool. Do you remember what about it?
No, I don't. It was more of just a gut. Yeah, it wasn't this like intellectual. Yeah. It's not a thing I feel like I can intellectualize. Like it was just this overwhelming feeling. I mean, maybe what Marsha Linehan would refer to as wise mind, where that, you know, where you're the rational, logical side of your mind intersects. If you think of a Venn diagram, intersects with your emotional mind. And in the middle is that sort of like feeling at peace, wise mind, that you just kind of know instinctually that like, this is the right thing.
Yeah. Oh, I love Marsha Linehan. Okay. So, you went and you applied for your PhD in clinical psychology. You ended up committing to BU. Mm-hmm. I think there was an episode either on your podcast or maybe somebody else's podcast. You were talking about imposter feelings when you
oh gosh, yeah.
Am I opening a can of worms? Can you talk to me about what that felt like for you to get into this clinical psych program working under David Barlow? What was that feeling like for you?
Oh my gosh. Well, so opening a can of worms that I am happy to have open, because I think this is such an important topic for us to be talking about, because I really do not know. I don't know many early career people that don't experience imposter syndrome, but also there's this belief, like if I just keep achieving and I get into this program or win that award or, you know, then I'll outrun it. I'll chase it away. And in fact, it seems to be the case that the opposite happens, because, you know, the higher you climb, the more you're expected to know. And, you know, so the bad news is it never goes away, but, but you know, 70% of us experience it. So, you know, I'm writing a book about this right now. It won't be out till next fall, but you know, I make the argument that like, we shouldn't be calling this a syndrome at all, because this is a really normal experience. And that seems to be especially true for people who have a history of marginalization, right? If you're a woman, a person of color, and someone in the LGBTQ community, a disabled person, you know, you have a history of being told you don't belong at all the tables. And so, you know, it's sort of natural to have this fear of being found out. For me, where that got really loud was I was going to this CBT class and there was a guest speaker and I again had the goosebumps. It was so bizarre. I walked in and I just had this overwhelming feeling that this person was going to change my life. And I had no idea who she was. She ended up lecturing on cognitive behavioral therapy and anxiety disorders and psychotherapy outcome research. And it was like everything I kind of knew I was interested in, but had never seen put together in one place. So I asked for her to meet with me, kind of like we were talking earlier, like this mentoring conversation, where I came to her saying, you know, these are all the things I'm interested in. I'm applying to graduate schools, but I would love to volunteer to work for you. Like, is there anything that I can do for you to learn more about the work you're doing? Because I think it's just fascinating. And she was really honest with me and said, I'm not going to put the resources into training you if you're going to graduate school, but if this is what you want to do, you need to apply to work with Dave Barlow at BU. And honestly, even though he's like one of the most well-known anxiety experts in the world at that point in my career, I had never heard of him before. And I was like, okay, but this was so long ago. You know, I wasn't even looking stuff up on the internet. I had a paper book that described all the different graduate programs in psychology. And, you know, so I'm looking at the information and I was like, oh my God, this program accepts 1-2% of its applicants. There is absolutely no way I am getting into this program. So the only reason I'm going to apply is because I had this weird mystical goosebump experience and Ariel Lang was her name, told me I should apply and I'm going to pay attention to the universe in this way. But I know with 100% certainty, I won't get in. And I also didn't tell my family because Boston was home for me. You know, I'm living in San Diego. Boston was home. I didn't want any pressure. I didn't want to have to deal with it, you know, to go back home. And then my guilt got the better of me. It just felt wrong that I was like keeping this big secret from my family. So I finally broke down and I confessed and I told my dad the story and said I was applying to BU and to work for, you know, David Barlow. And he goes, Dave Barlow, the psychologist? And I was like, wait, what? My dad's a businessman. Like he knows nothing about mental health and psychology. And I was like, how do you know him? And he's like, oh, we play golf at the same club. I've played golf with him a few times. And so that was this like bizarre small world thing. Well, he bumped into him shortly thereafter and said, oh, hey, my kid is applying to your program. And Dave said, great, have her email me her materials. So instead of my materials going into the slush pile, they went straight to Dave Barlow's email and he wrote right back to me and said, you know, impressive credentials. We look forward to reviewing your, you know, your file. And, you know, the long story short, I got in, obviously. And so that was I started BU in 2001. So that would have been in 2000. So 22 years ago, that happened. I have since done, you know, fairly well for myself. I think? Did fine in the program, right? Like I've been successful. And to this day, I still worry that the only reason I got in is because my dad knew him. Now, they weren't buddies. you know, they weren't like BFFs, but he knew him. And it's that imposter feeling of like, you know, like I didn't really deserve this. I only got in for this reason. Mm. And the entire time I was in graduate school, I was just waiting for everybody to find out that I was like a total fraud and I didn't really belong there and that everybody else was there. Now, if you think about it, this is actually really insulting to Dave Barlow, right? Like he had 12 spots. And his students coming out and being successful is a reflection on him and his program. So the likelihood that he would just like give away one of 12 spots to some golf buddies, not even a buddy, like a golf acquaintance's child is slim. And the rational side of me knows that.
Yeah.
But that like fear-based emotional side of me, like, I mean, I don't know. Like, is it pot? Do you think my dad paid him off? But like, I'm pretty sure Dave Barlow is like way more ethical than that.
Yeah.
But that's the way that imposter brain works, you know? Yeah.
What you're describing too is, I know on your website, you have a quiz that helps people identify sort of what kind of imposter feelings they kind of are categorized as. So I took it actually, and mine are perfectionism, which I completely predicted going into it. I think yours is expert, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what it is, these subtypes, this is Valerie Young's work.
Mm-hmm.
And what the subtypes are, they describe the strategies we use to compensate for imposter feelings to try to prevent being revealed as a fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And so for you, you are perfectionistic. And as long as you do everything at the very highest standard and never make any mistakes, then people won't figure out that you are actually an imposter.
Mm-hmm.
And so then when you don't do something perfectly and you do make a mistake, then it like reinforces those feelings, those imposter feelings. The expert is the person who I'm just going to take one more class, one more certificate, read one more book, listen to one more podcast. Like if I could just get enough knowledge and expertise, then maybe I'll finally feel legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are three other subtypes. Do you want me to talk about those?
Please.
Yeah. So there's the natural genius, which is the person who believes you should just know everything. Like you should get it right the first time. Like if you hear it once, you should know it, that intelligence, like either you have it or you don't. It's kind of like, Carol Dweck's fixed mindset.
Yes.
It's a little bit similar to that. And so then if it doesn't come easily to you, then you feel like a fraud. There's the soloist,
yes,
which is the person who feels they need to do everything on their own, and anything they do like as part of a group or if they need to ask for help shows that they're a fraud. And then there's the superhuman, which is similar to the perfectionist, but it's this like, I should be able to do all the things all the time flawlessly with a smile on my face. You know, kind of the perfectionist that overdoes it type of thing. And so if you take some on my website, if you just go to jillstoddard.com and look for take the quiz, you can take this brief quiz and then it tells you which of those. Now, you will likely recognize yourself a little bit in more than one, maybe even all of them.
Yeah.
But there's usually one that sort of rises to the top as the predominant strategies for trying to not feel like a fraud or protect yourself from being revealed as a fraud.
Mm. How has this sort of expert imposter sort of feelings, how has that showed up since you finished your PhD?
Oh my gosh. Well, I tell this whole, so if people take the quiz, or even if they don't, you can sign up for my newsletter and I just send it once a month or sometimes less because I get really busy and give myself permission to skip a month. And I share very brief tips that are typically based in acceptance and commitment therapy. But also I do a lot about imposter syndrome. And then of course I'll announce when my book comes out, but I talk in detail about all of these things, including my entire trajectory of how this expert thing has played out. And for me, it's really been predominantly in the realm of writing. And so you asked me earlier, I don't remember how you phrased the question, but it was like whether I had had an undergrad experience that, do you remember what I'm talking about?
I do remember. And people,
you know, that
remember,
sort of like triggered me to know, like, this was the path I wanted to take. And I really did not have anything specific that stands out with psychology. But when I look back, like the only experience I really, really remember with clarity was I took a creative writing class as an elective. And I wrote a story about a difficult experience I was having at home. And I remember I got an A- on the paper. It's literally the only grade I remember. Mm-hmm. And I remember that I was capitalizing pronouns, you know, she, her. It was like a thing I was trying. And my teacher said, don't do that. It's too gimmicky. And I remember that specific feedback. Uh-huh. It's these are the only details I remember from anything, you know, assignment wise and academic. And it was the first time I'd ever written a personal essay. And then, you know, fast forward many years and I talk more about the story in the book, but it made me realize like I always wanted to write and I really have a passion for creative writing, not just professional writing. I'd obviously done a lot of writing in graduate school, which I didn't particularly like. God, I would never want to write another dissertation again, as long as I live. I don't think anybody would. But, and so anyway, I don't know, 12 years ago, maybe I started doing some creative writing and holy cow, did I feel like a fraud, right? Like who the heck am I to think that like, I'm not a writer. And when I had my idea for my first book, which is it's called The Big Book of ACT Metaphors, and it's metaphors and experiential practices that people can use in acceptance and commitment therapy. I had the idea for the book and then immediately was like, who do you think you are? You're not a writer. You mm-hmm. don't write books. You're not enough of an expert in ACT to do this. And so the imposter stuff was like really showing up a lot around mm-hmm. writing. So I started taking classes and workshops. I read, I don't know, 7 books about writing. Mm-hmm. I joined, when I first started creative writing, I was doing more children's books. So I joined the Society for Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. I listened to, I don't even know how many podcasts, and on and on and on and yeah. on. And when I added it all up over a period of like just a few years, I had spent $20,000.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Trying to get more knowledge, more expertise.
Because I just never felt like I was enough. Mm. You know, like I had enough knowledge to belong in this I don't community, you know, like in like the writing community was not mine. I'm a psychologist who's a wannabe writer. They're real writers. I'm not a real writer. Mm. And it was like I was just waiting for this day to come where I just had done enough that I felt like I belonged in the place where I could say, I'm a writer. I'm a psychologist and I'm a writer. I'm an author. When I went to write my Twitter profile, mm-hmm. I initially wrote author or writer and was like, you can't do that. You're not an author. Who do you think you are? You can't yeah. write author. And the reason I was setting up a Twitter profile was because I was writing my third book. Like I had already published 2 books, right? So like how many books do you have to write before
you can be a writer
can call themselves a writer, right? And so that's where my expert like really comes out in those ways. Mm.
So first of all, I relate to, I'm predominantly the perfectionist type, but I also really relate to this expert type too. And it shows up similarly for me as well, especially around like now I'm building a team around, you know, at PsychMic. And I feel like I need to do more reading about leadership, about being an effective leader before I can take this on. And it's like this fear of learning experientially because really it stems from a fear of what would happen if I failed and how it would look if I failed or if I failed my team. And I want to just make sure I have it all in my noggin before. Okay. So here's where I think I want to bring in the conversation about ACT, which clearly has helped you a lot, to overcome and fight through or work through, these imposter feelings and other, you know, anxiety related feelings and stress in your life, and in your patients. So first, what is ACT and when did it come into play for you in your professional career?
Yeah. Well, I want to say one quick thing first before I forget, which uh-huh. is, you know, related to the expert thing and, you know, you wanting to learn more about leadership and me wanting to learn more about the writing, you know, the author, the writing industry, mm-hmm. there's nothing wrong with getting educated, mm-hmm. right? Like it's not a bad thing to engage in skill building and to get knowledge. But I think what you said that's critically important is I feel like I have to do this before. right? So people get into this waiting pattern.
Yes.
Of, well, I will do this thing once I yes. feel this way or have enough of this or have enough of that. You know, or like I've spent so much time reading and researching that I'm not actually doing the writing or submitting the writing
yeah.
or publishing the podcast or hiring the person or whatever it is. So it's, you know, and so then to answer your ACT question is like what ACT allows folks to do is to become an observer of those stories, to notice that narrative without getting hooked by it and to choose to do the thing anyway, you know, mm-hmm. to make those bold moves because they're important to you, even though you're afraid you're going to fail, even though there's all this uncertainty and self-doubt, even though there's the story saying, ooh, I don't know if you should do that. And so, you know, what ACT is it is a therapy that is designed to build psychological flexibility. And what that means is our ability to be in this present moment, because that's the only one we've got, with all of our thoughts and feelings, fully and without defense. So like without doing anything to suppress them or push them away, without getting hooked by thoughts and just listening to them as if they're little mini dictators in charge of everything. And to choose behavior that's based on values. And values are like what I like to call the me I want to be. Mm-hmm. You know, who, what do I want to do? But most importantly, how do I want to do it? How do I want to show up? What are the qualities I want to embody mm-hmm. as a human? You know, what do I want to make important if I'm trying to cultivate a life that's meaningful? So that's ACT in a nutshell.
Yeah, I'm sure we could spend like you've spent hundreds of episodes at this point on Psychologists Off the Clock talking about ACT. Actually, I don't know if 100 about ACT, more than 100 about ACT, but that you are all probably. ACT practitioner, maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
You are all ACT practitioners, so this is not an ACT podcast, but I think a lot of students, and I will say that if you're interested in learning more in depth, if you're like really into this, go listen to Psychologists Off the Clock and get to know more about this therapy and how it actually plays out.
Yeah, and I'll add to that, there's an episode before I was a co-host, I was a super fan,
yeah.
But I also was a guest on two episodes. And the very first one I did, I think it's episode 77, and we've had over 200.
Yes,
now.
It is.
Is it 77?
It is 77.
Me being interviewed about acceptance and commitment therapy. So we've done a yes. lot of episodes that have ACT as part of them, but like this is probably the one episode that's like all about like, here's what it is.
Yes.
Here's how we do it.
Yes.
So that would be a good place for people to start. And then if they like it, there's plenty of other episodes that get yes. into, you know, different nuances. And I do one talking about my book, Be Mighty. And, yes. and there's lots of other ones too about
so much.
Anger and all sorts of things. Yeah.
Yeah. I really, really love ACT. Bridget is the one who introduced me to it. I've since read your book and I've talked to other clinicians who practice in this area. I resonate with it a lot. I recognize there are people who might not, but I really do. And
me too.
I know. Let's actually go back to your path really quick, because we haven't even talked about you. We haven't even talked about the Center for Stress and Anxiety Management that you founded and now direct at in San Diego, which you founded pretty much right after you finished your PhD, right?
I finished my PhD, you know, had to do 1,500 hours post PhD before lecture. But pretty much the minute I got licensed, I opened my practice. Now, I also had a full-time job at the VA. Mm. You know, my dad is an entrepreneur and not remotely risk averse. And I got bitten by that bug a little, but with yeah. much more risk aversion. And so for me, I just wanted to have a stable paycheck and get my, I don't know, you know, just like have some stability initially. So I started out, you know, just doing like one day a week or a few hours. I don't even remember at this point. And then just kind of slowly built up over time and then went full-time private practice, maybe, I don't know, 4 years ago or something like that.
Wow. What were you doing at the VA?
I did both my internship and postdoc there. And then mm-hmm. I was in a primary care clinic. And mm-hmm. I was in I had always kind of done like partially anxiety, mostly anxiety and a little bit of behavioral medicine. So mm. I did some time in a primary care unit. And then I was in a PTSD, mm. You know, trauma clinic.
What
and
is then, it?
And that was like maybe think I was there maybe 2 years after postdoc. And then I switched over to, I was faculty at a professional school, Alliant International University.
Yes.
And I did that plus my private practice for 9 years.
Wow. And okay. So I actually wrote this down at the beginning of our interview and I actually never asked you, why anxiety? And it might be an obvious question, but why anxiety? Like what?
It's an obvious question at all. Okay. Yeah. People ask me all the time and I'm like, wait, why did I go into anxiety? Because some people have stories of like, oh, my mom had panic attacks or I had panic attacks. You know, they say research is me search.
Yeah.
And I had no experience like that. It turns out I do have anxious people in my family, but I didn't know till I was in graduate school learning about anxiety and was like, oh, that's what's going on with her. No, I think it was... I really liked how powerfully effective the treatments for anxiety were. And specifically, I just found exposure therapy to be the most fascinating. Like, wow, I get to take people to go face their fear and do like the scariest thing and then be free. I mean, that just was like so incredibly appealing to me. Mm. And so that's, and in a relatively brief period of time.
Yeah. Bridget talked about that too, actually, in our episode about exposure therapy and you know how she approaches OCD and like other similar disorders, and the fact that she loved that she could go out and like help people face their fears like in the real world. She could actually leave the office, and that was a cool part about these these CBT therapies. Which also just as a note, so ACT it was kind of born out of CBT, but it's like a third wave. It's a third wave therapy.
Yeah, it's kind of under the larger umbrella of CBT, but it's a third wave therapy. So it focuses on context and process over kind content. Of content. It's about function rather than form. And then of course has a mindfulness component like all the third wave therapies do. Mm.
So I want to spend some time on this, on the center. It's wild to me that you immediately like started up this private practice right out of, I mean, yeah, it's to me, it's just seems like it's a big undertaking as a freshly like licensed therapist. And I know you said, you know, financial stability was part of the decision. What else, you know, appealed to you about the lifestyle of being a private practitioner and potentially also being, you know, the head of this and having practitioners under you who you got to mentor and train as well?
I think at the time I decided to start it, it truly was, you know, my whole life, I was raised by someone who was his own boss. I never knew my dad to work for anyone else. He was always, you know, starting and building companies. And I saw how much energy that gave him, you know, that he just felt alive when he was creating something out of nothing and providing work opportunities for other people. My dad was, his companies always had very good retention. So he did a really good job of making sure his staff felt valued. They didn't want to leave. Mm. And all of that, you know, I was never interested in like business per se, but there was something about, I think it's, you know, back to the writing. I didn't realize I love writing. It makes me realize like, oh, I never would have called myself creative, but I was creative. You know, like I didn't know how to paint, right? Like, or play an instrument or sing, but I think there's this part of me and really truly every human that had this need to be creative. And for me starting the clinic, that's what it was. I got to name it. I got to pick my logo. I got to decide where my office would be and how I would decorate it and what our specialty would be and what the forms would look like and the process for getting people in the door. And, you know, that just, I think that like, I mean, gosh, maybe it makes me sound like a total control freak and maybe I am, but to me, I think it was really about like the creative element of that and just like building something from nothing that was going to be a service to our community.
Yeah. Did you have at the time that you started it, did you know that you wanted to employ other people at some point?
I don't remember, honestly. Huh. You know what? No, I do remember because I was initially going to start with a partner who ended up not being able to follow through. And I remember the first, not disagreement, but like sort of like a question that came up between us that we had to decide is I immediately wanted to call it the Center for Whatever. And she was like, ooh, I don't know, because it's just you and me and we're not really a center. And can we do that? And I said, but what I'm thinking about is what I want to grow to. Huh. And if we just call it Jill Stoddard, and then that's what my website is and where I am out in the world, and then it gets built to a center and then we have to change it, that just doesn't make sense to me. You know what I mean? Like, I want to call it I want it to be more about what my vision is, and this is going to be what we're working towards. So yes, I actually must have seen it in that way.
Yeah.
Because I specifically remembered that conversation about, you know, wanting it to be a center and hoping that would mean other people would work there and it would grow over time.
Mm, that was one of my questions. What was your vision for the center? Mm. Last time we spoke, you mentioned that a huge benefit of having this center is financial. And a lot of people worry when they go into a clinical career that it's not going to be that financially stable, depending on the settings that they work and the populations they work with. So I would like to spend some time on this and how it's become that for you. And any advice that you have too for my audience who are thinking about going this route.
So I think the number one benefit, and this wasn't the reason I did it because I didn't know this, I learned this through experience. But for me now at this stage of my life, the biggest benefit is the flexibility. Mm. You know, as a woman who's a career-driven person, you know, my career is very important to me. I love working. You know, it's my mission in life to spread ACT and psychological flexibility to as many people as I can. And I also wanted to be a mom. Mm. And having kids and being a career woman, if you have a job where you're expected to be, you know, at the faculty meeting at 8 a.m. on Wednesday, but school drop-off doesn't happen till 8:05 and you have to live 30 minutes away because you can't afford the town where the university is, it just becomes impossible. You know, these like big organizations and systems are not set up to support working moms or working parents in general. But, you know, we know still, even though men are doing much more, women still do 60% or more of the household stuff, even when they're working, even when they're the primary breadwinner. So the flexibility is, you know, like you just can't put a price tag on it. Mm. And then financially, even if you're a single person in private practice without a center and without people working for you, you can certainly make more money. You know, if you think about working like at a hospital or a clinic or for the county, you're often expected to see 8 people a day. You know, there's not a lot of time built in for admin and all these other things. And you're doing 8 people a day, 5 days a week. And maybe you make $100,000, $110,000. If you do the math on 40 people a week and you're charging around $200, $150 to $225, depending where you live, right? New York City versus somewhere in the middle of nowhere, Iowa, are going to be 2 different things. But
right.
Same with the $100,000 salary, they'll be 2 different things. But you know, if you do the math on that, it's at least double. And so even though you have to pay some overhead, it's much less than you think it would be. Even your health insurance, you know, the health insurance you get from an organization isn't necessarily all it's cracked up to be. You still pay a lot out of pocket a lot of times. It's totally workable. The drawback is, and you get the flexibility. The drawback is if you don't work, you don't get paid, right? If you want to take vacations, when you have sick time, you know, you can get short-term disability insurance, which I recommend so that if something happens or if you need to take maternity leave, but you know, maternity leaves aren't paid in other organizations either. Mm-hmm. When you set it up the way that I've set it up, where I have a team of women who work for me, I keep a percentage of what they make. And people always say, well, why would they work for you if you take some of their money? Well, not everyone wants to be a business owner, right? They want to show up and see their clients and go home and not have to think about it.
Yeah. And also the clientele is, you know, it's kind of built, not built in, but it's, you've built up a reputation, right? At the center where people know about you and come to you. And so you don't have to worry about the stress of building up your own clientele.
Exactly. Yep. So that's often why people start with me. But then the question is like, well, why do they stay once they have their own, you know, reputation? And you know, a lot of that is you still have to do the work to get the people in the door. You still have to have a website. You have to screen all your calls. It's a lot of work to, you know, run a business. Mm-hmm. And people don't want to do that. And so for me, what that means is obviously I make a lot more money the more clients I personally see, but I can take vacation and not be super stressed out about it because I have passive income.
Yeah.
Right? Mm. The business is always making money, even if I'm not working. Mm. And it means I'm not lonely, right? Like a lot of times when you're a single practitioner in private practice, it's like just you. And I recommend for people who do that to get a consultation group. I've had mine for over 10 years. We meet almost every month. And sometimes we don't even talk about cases. We'll talk about business or we'll just shoot the shit about our personal lives. Oh, sorry. Can I swear?
Of course.
Or we'll just shoot the bull about our personal lives in case you need to use that one. and it's a godsend. I mean, I love having it, but also having the clinic is this built-in support and team. And, you know, we really care about each other and value each other. And I bring my team and their partners for like a fancy dinner in the winter. And then in the summer, they bring their families to my house and we have a casual barbecue.
Yeah.
Before COVID, we started doing like an every other month kind of lunch and learn where I'd bring an expert in and we'd all learn something for an hour. Never mandatory because people don't get paid for those things, right? So it's up to them. But everybody always comes when they can because they like seeing each other too. So, you know, I've just found it to be incredibly fulfilling. I live in Southern California, which is a very expensive place to live. I'm the primary breadwinner in my family. I have two kids, my own family and my in-laws all live on the East Coast. You know, so what I was telling you, Maya, when we had met prior to recording is money is something that's important to me, not because I want to buy super nice things. Although I like that sometimes too, but because my family is really far away and I want to be, you know, we decided last minute to hop on a plane for spring break and go back East so we could be with family. And that costs a lot of money for a family of four to do for a week. And I'm able to do all those things. I'm not rich. If I wanted to move out of the house I currently live in and buy a different house in California, I couldn't because, you know, real estate's so crazy right now. But we live very comfortably and, you know, can do all the things that we want to do. And that's all because of the practice.
Last time we spoke, I think it's really hard I don't think a lot of people my age really consider like what my salary would be if I work in XYZ settings for XYZ amount of hours and with these kinds of patients in this state or in this city. Like I haven't done that like full analysis yet because I'm still figuring out what the heck I want to do. But I think it's helpful to like talk about numbers. And I know you mentioned last time that that was something you felt comfortable talking about. Do you feel,
I do.
Do you feel comfortable?
I do. Here's the thing. We have this weird cultural taboo about money and that you're not supposed to talk about how much money you make and this and that. And, you know, there's actually a movement. It's part of the feminist movement that when you think about who that taboo benefits, it's the people at the top. And when you think about that, you know, there are people who say that one of the biggest ways that we can end the gender pay gap is to just talk openly about our salaries.
I never considered that.
there's a story. I interviewed a psychologist named David Smith who wrote a book called Good Guys that's all about how men can be more supportive of equality, gender equality. And he tells a story about two colleagues who had essentially an identical CV in terms of their qualifications and experience and whatnot. And they were up for tenure or promotion or whatever it was. And the male colleague deliberately scheduled his meeting, his evaluation meeting, prior to his female colleague so that he would know what he was being offered. Or maybe it was a job offer, not a promotion. I don't remember the details, but that's in Psychologists Off the Clock too, if you want to hear the story. Anyway,
I'll link it.
So he got his offer and then he went to her immediately and said, "This is how much they've offered me. Do not settle for a penny less." And she went in and they offered her $8,000 less.
Why am I in shock? Like, I already know, that I'm still in shock though.
I
don't get it.
And so she said, "No, you offered my colleague this amount. Like, I'm not taking anything less than this." And they gave it to her. That never should have happened in the first place, but it does. And if he hadn't had that conversation with her, she would have never known and probably wouldn't have negotiated. Not not that high anyway. And that was, I think, his first offer that they had made.
Wow.
And when I was hired at Alliant, I was hired at the same time as a male colleague, and we discussed what we were offered. And I am happy to say we were offered the exact same amount of money.
Yay, Alliant.
And so, right? Yay, Alliant. And so way back then, that was in 2008 or 2009, and that was a starting assistant professor salary at a professional school, and it was $65,000 at that time. I did not negotiate, and I wish I had, because then every time we had a review for a bump, it was a percentage of the base salary. So people, don't be afraid to negotiate, even if you just get a couple thousand dollars more. And what's the worst that happens? They say no, right? Mm-hmm. So that was that job. What I hear around here in San Diego for psychologists that are kind of like, I don't know what the starting salaries are, honestly. Mm-hmm. I would guess they're maybe like 80 to 85 if you work somewhere like the VA or a hospital setting for a psychologist, master's level or less. And then typically people are topping out as clinical staff, in the low 100s, 110, 115 maybe is what I hear. And of course, there may be some variability to that. Mm-hmm. People who have research careers are able to supplement that with grant money.
Yeah.
I don't know what the range is there because I don't do that. And I'm not really in that world anymore. Mm-hmm. In private practice, you sort of decide because it depends how much you work. Mm-hmm. So like I have, one of the people who works for me makes $250,000 a year because she works a lot. I would never want to work that much. but I mean, my other staff who work quite a bit less than her are making probably $175,000. Now that's gross, right? Not net. And they have to pay taxes and they have to buy their own health insurance. And, but that's still with taking some vacation time and, they're working, they're seeing 25 patients, whereas, at the hospital or the county or wherever, you're expected to see a lot more than that for a lot less.
Yeah.
Right. So it's really kind of like half the work for double the pay or half the work for the same amount of pay.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Versus the same amount of work for double the pay.
Right. And then your center, I mean, you told me last time brings in over $1 million a year in revenue.
Just over a million. Brings just over 1.1 or 1.2, I think, this year in revenue.
This is helpful.
Gross revenue. And the profit is probably around 10%.
Yeah.
But 10% is it's not, how do I put this? It's an underestimate because you can flow so many business expenses through your company.
Yes.
So like if I worked for the VA and I was going to conferences and all these things, I'd be paying out of pocket for that. They're not paying for that for me, the place I work for. When I pay, my private practice pays all that. So that reduces my taxable income.
Yeah.
It also, right. So it makes it look like the company's making less profit, but it's like money I would have been spending anyway. Does that make sense?
Yes. 100%. Yes. No, it does.
You can lease your car through your business if you're using it for, enough. Yeah. Have to get a good accountant and know what is allowed. I'm not going to give financial advice because I rely on professionals who know about those things to tell me what's okay and what's not. But there are a lot of things that you can flow through your business legally to reduce your taxable income. And so it makes it look like the profit margin's quite a bit less, but there are things that hopefully you get what I'm saying.
I get what you're saying. I didn't until very recently when someone who owns a business told me like, you can just write that off. And I'm like, what does that mean?
Right. All the books you buy when you're wanting to learn how to do ACT, all the praxis courses you take to get CEs, like all of that stuff goes through the business. And then it's money like you're not paying out of pocket and it's reducing your taxable income. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I make this profit and pay myself this. So I pay myself a salary. And I only pay myself about $80,000 a year as a salary. Mm-hmm. I also make other money, not very much, but writing books, speaking, I do a lot of public speaking. In fact, I do more of that than therapy these days. So I pay myself that salary, and then the business itself makes a profit that I can use. I can pay myself what's called distribution. So if I've got a big travel trip coming up or something, that's money that I can spend. And then of course, like I don't have to use my salary and those profits to pay a bunch of my expenses because they're expenses I write off through the business. So
I don't know where the heck else I would have gotten this information. So thank you. Thank you for doing that. Thank you for, you know, demystifying it a little bit.
Yeah. And I also, I mean, I want to take care not to make it sound too rosy. Mm-hmm. It is really hard work. And I started my private practice, I think in 2008. And I am today at the point where I'm only seeing about, you know, I don't know, 3 to 5 clients a week. But like I said, I do other things also to make money. But it took me many years of very hard work to get my business to that place. So, you know, I don't want people to say like, oh, Jill said I can do this and make 200 grand a year. I'm just going to like, get my license and hang my shingle and be rich. Yeah. You know, it takes a while to build up a caseload, to get a reputation.
Yeah.
I've done a ton earlier on pro bono talks in the community so that people would know who I am, so that people will refer clients to our center. You know, lots of time that I was not being compensated for to create a profitable and successful business.
You mentioned a bunch of other activities that you're involved in. Let's just name them. So you mentioned public speaking. By the way, guys, I will link this in the show notes. Go check out Jill's TED Talk. It is wonderful. I did the pencil.
The pen exercise.
Yes.
Yeah, I love it.
I kind of hurt myself with my nails. I got to cut them, but.
You were squeezing hard.
I was squeezing hard for Psych Mike. Yeah. But your speaking, your articles, your books have helped me so much, like just in my life. I'm currently looking for a therapist. But like just having these resources accessible that I can like do on my own and read about and learn about on my own is so powerful. So guys, go check out Jill's TED Talk. I will link her website and her her podcast, her books. There's so much out there that you can explore. But so I mentioned public speaking, podcasting, writing. What else am I missing?
I mean, that's predominantly it. I mean, one exercise I'll recommend. So ACT is a heavily experiential therapy where we use a lot of metaphors and experiential exercises. And one exercise I like to do to kind of get at values is, you know, companies all have a mission, vision, and values statement. And I like to write my own mission, vision, and values, both for, you know, kind of my personal life and also my professional life. And so for me, my mission in my professional life is to share ACT concepts, evidence-based concepts from psychology, but specifically ACT and psychological flexibility with as many people as I can. And what I realized is not everyone can afford therapy. And by the way, I'll also say, kind of going back to our money conversation, my clinic doesn't take insurance. And I feel conflicted about that because it means the only people getting our services are people who have resources.
Yeah.
We do keep some of our slots at a sliding scale. We do a handful of pro bono cases. Mm-hmm. But the reality of insurance is it's literally twice the work for half the pay. And so we are cash only. And so I recognize that not everyone has the resources to be able to afford individual therapy, and not everyone has the desire, and not everyone needs therapy. And, you know, I have all of this knowledge and information that has helped me personally so much in my life. And I've seen how powerfully it's helped my clients that I really, you know, I wanted to take this gift of having this center and passive income. Like I don't have to see a ton of clients anymore. So that freed up so much of my time. So I really wanted to use that time to spread the word to more people. And so that's where my choice to wear these other hats came from. Podcasting is an incredible way to reach lots of people for free. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, we don't make any money yet, but that is a goal that someday we will. Same. But, you know, we can offer this information to people for free. You know, same with writing books. It's a lot easier for people to spend $14 on a self-help book than to spend $200 a session on therapy.
Yeah.
And then speaking is where I do generate some other income, but I have different prices for for-profit versus nonprofit organizations. And I do still do some pro bono stuff, but not quite as much as I used to. Mm. And then that way, you know, that's a way to kind of supplement, but it means a corporation is paying me to give free information to their staff, right? So they're not the ones who are having to pay. I'm talking to 50, 100 or more people and teaching them evidence-based skills for stress management, anxiety, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You know, and they're not having to pay for that other than their time and their effort. And so I just love being able to wear those hats and do those different things. And it's a creativity again. Right? Like I find therapy to be very creative, even though I see only anxiety disorders. You'd be surprised at how different every session and every plan can be. But this just lets me be that much more creative, podcasting, writing, speaking.
I have a couple more questions for you. If we don't get to all of them, that's okay. But first, so you just mentioned that you, each case, you know, each anxiety case is so different and you're still learning and you're still loving it. What does anything still give you chills?
Oh. Yeah, totally.
What gives you chills?
I have a client that I mean, this is a good example. This just happened like yesterday, actually. I have a client who, so I do short-term therapy. I only do 12 sessions with people. My other staff don't limit to 12, but I do. And that's actually something new for me. But I have clients who will see me off and on for years and years, right? So like one of my oldest clients that I've been seeing since I first started my practice, she'll see me, I won't see her for 3 years and then she'll come back because something's going on in her life and she wants to do a couple booster sessions. So that happened recently, haven't seen her in a while. And the reason that she wanted to come back wasn't like, I'm really suffering and struggling and I need your help. It was, I want to report to you this like really amazing good news. And I don't want to share specifically what it is because I don't want it to be identifying, but you know, she just got like really, really good news. She had a huge goal, two huge goals actually that were both realized at the same time. And you know, basically wanted to come in and talk about that. And once in a blue moon, you know, I get an email from a former client telling me something really exciting, that something positive and good that's happening in their life that they kind of credit therapy for, right? Like I wouldn't be doing this if it weren't for the work we had done together.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's, I think those wins like still really give me chills. Absolutely give me chills. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I love that. Do you ever worry that your clients are like looking you up and like listening to all your podcasts and like share, like obviously you're monitoring what you're sharing, so it's not like the things that you don't want your clients to know about. But I don't know, is there ever any element of you that's like worried about that?
I'm not worried about it. I'm 100% certain they're doing it. I mean, if I'm getting a new therapist, you can bet I'm going to Google them.
Yeah.
Like it would be dumb not to in a way, right? Like you want to do your due diligence.
Yeah.
So I don't worry about it. I know they are. And then that factors into my decisions. And for me, one of my, you know, because I live and breathe ACT and psychological flexibility, you know, authenticity is one of my most important values. And I try to put myself out into the world in an authentic way. If people go to my website, you'll see, like, I tell a pretty kind of personal story about growing up, that I was called Tubby and Little Tubbet and Tubby 2x4. And like, that's right out there on my website that if you're a potential client, I mean, most clients find me through my clinic website, not my Jill Stoddard website. They're different. But you know, you find jillstoddard.com if you're Googling me and searching. And you know, so that's something that I definitely sort of pause over and think like, is this something that clients should know or would want to know, or could this be potentially counterindicated clinically? So I'm always thinking about those things, because I know that they're going to find,
My last question is, what is one skill, quality, or general factor that has served you no matter where you went in life? It does not have to be intrinsic, by the way.
I mean, it's psychological flexibility, hands down. Like there's just no I don't even have to think about it. Mm-hmm. You know, the ability to have a different relationship with thoughts and feelings so that I can make choices that make my life big and bold and meaningful. It's just such a gift to live my life that way. And I'm not mm-hmm. perfect at it. I still avoid all the time. Don't mm-hmm. get me wrong. I do. Mm-hmm. I'm still a human being. And you know, what's funny is, I sort of tell people like, well, the bad news is I've been doing this ACT thing, living it, not just teaching it and doing therapy, but you know, for over 20 years, and I'm more anxious than I've ever been in my life. And they're like, what? Does that mean it doesn't work? But here's why. Like, I also feel more alive than I've ever felt in my life. And the reason I'm anxious is because I take huge risks, right? Like, yeah. So for the podcast, for example, if I think about some like big famous person that I want to interview, my mind says, who do you think you are? You can't do that. You're nobody. Or even when I was invited to be a co-host of the podcast, what? You're not a podcaster. You don't know anything. Who do you think you are? It's all impostery stuff, right? And I say yes and say yes and say yes. And I get rejected all the time.
Yeah.
But I can handle it, mm-hmm. you know? And it's, there are so many opportunities that I would have turned down if not for embodying psychological flexibility. And I'm in love with my life, and it's not because it's been easy. And so that's like really the thing that I think has allowed me to truly flourish and thrive both professionally and personally.
You're awesome, Jill. Wish I had another day with you to ask you questions.
Well, we can always do a second interview when the book comes out.
Okay, that was one last thing. Is when can we find it, and where?
I think it's coming out like September of 2023.
Okay,
I think that's right. Yeah, maybe August. And it's if you sign up for my newsletter, I'll announce it when the time gets closer. But you know, when Amazing. The time comes, it'll be available on my website and on Amazon and all the places you find
all the places.
Bookshop.org, shop independent if you can.
Okay. Good stuff. And it's about imposter phenomenon. Yes.
It is for professionals. So I was initially going to write it just for writers because I related to that so much, but expanded the audience to be all professionals. So it'll be perfect for those of us in the mental health world who get a healthy dose of this. Yeah.
Well, I can't wait. I've always enjoyed your writing. So thank you so much for being here, for offering all of this honest and authentic advice and reflections about your life. You are amazing. And I can't wait to see
you
continue to thrive and flourish.
Thank you. Well, you're amazing too. I love that you're doing this work, and it is such a needed resource. I wish I had had something like it when I was at that stage of my career. And I hope lots of people find you.
Thank you so much. Wait, don't go yet. If you've been loving Psych Mike, make sure you subscribe to the weekly newsletter, where you'll learn even more detailed approaches about how to get from where you are now to where you want to go with your psych background. When you sign up on psychmike.com, we will send you invaluable grad school resources, career advice, job opportunities, and early access to events that will help you learn to take your psych background to the next level. It would also mean the absolute world to me if you subscribed to Psych Mike and took a moment to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. I just love seeing that you've benefited from this show or that you've enjoyed listening to the episodes, and it also just helps more people discover the show. It can just take you a few seconds, but it'll make my whole entire day. So please, please, if you can, take a moment and leave a review. Thank you so much for tuning in and supporting Psych Mike. And I cannot wait to catch you next week.